Okay. So let us carry on a little bit. So now we have the Buddha is going off to visit Venerable Bhagu, who is staying in the this Balakalonaka Gama. And this is what happens when he goes there. The Bhagu saw the Buddha coming off in the distance. So he spread out the seat and placed water for washing the feet. The Buddha sat down on the seat spread out and washed his feet. This is a standard kind of a passage in the suttas. You find this everywhere. You make the seat ready and you put out water for washing the feet. Sometimes you also put out a foot scraper. Foot scrapers were used a lot in those days, and a stool to sit down on. This were kind of the usual equipment for inviting someone when they came. And interesting here is that the Buddha washes his own feet, which is kind of interesting, because these days if you're a monk, people, you know, it's kind of almost embarrassing, because people sometimes wash your feet as a monk. When the Buddha washes his own feet, it's kind of, whoa, I'm not sure sure about this. So that's kind of fascinating here. So sometimes the Buddha was very down to earth sometimes. Bhagu bowed to the Buddha and sat down to one side. The Buddha on page top of page 27, in case you wonder where we are here. The Buddha said to him, "I hope you are keeping well, mendicant. I hope you are all right. And I hope you're having no trouble getting alms food." "I'm keeping well, sir. I'm all right. I have no trouble getting alms food." This is always very touching. This is almost always the way the Buddha greets his monastic disciples. Always ask them, first of all, how are you? Are you keeping well? Are you getting enough alms food, right? Of course, alms food being very important to sustain your life, especially for the monastic, that you have no illnesses and these kind of things. And the kind of the ideal in the Vinaya is that if you are the preceptor or the teacher, you're supposed to look at the people who ordain with you as your sons and daughters. And the sons and daughters, the people who ordain under the Buddha, they're supposed to look at the Buddha as their father in a sense. So you have that kind of almost like this father-son relationship. Yeah? And this is kind of what you see here. Yeah, you see the kind of the care that is put in there, making sure that your monastic disciples are okay. And this is what we mean when very often the suttas, you see the suttas often start off by, you know, pleasant talk together. This is the kind of talk that is meant by that. So everyone is at ease, everyone feels comfortable, everyone feels that there is compassion in the air, kindness in the air. And when you feel relaxed because there's compassion and kindness, then you are ready to hear the Dhamma. If you sit down and you straight away ask a question about the Dhamma, yeah, no time to say even hello, then how can you relax, right? You wonder what's going on. So you have to use a bit of psychology, human psychology, to understand how human beings work, so they can actually get the message across in the right way. But little things like that are actually quite nice. Then the Buddha, educated and courage, fired up and inspired Bhagu with the Dhamma talk, after which he got up from his seat and set out from the eastern bamboo park. So this is the whole of that little incident. So the Buddha obviously found that Venerable Bhagu was a good monk, and when a monk is good and the monk is willing to listen, then the Buddha will give him a talk. He will educate, encourage, fire up and inspire Bhagu with the Dhamma talk, because he knows that he will take it to heart and he will practice in the right way. So this is how the ideal relationship, if you like, between teacher and student, Buddha and disciple. What happens next? Now at that time, the Venerables Anuruddha, Nandiya and Kimbila were staying in the eastern bamboo park. The park keeper saw the Buddha coming off in the distance and said to the Buddha, "Don't come into this park, ascetic. There are three gentlemen who love themselves staying here. don't disturb them. So this is a slightly interesting passage. First of all, I have to say, three gentlemen who love themselves. I'm not sure if that is how I would translate this. It is a slightly curious translation. But it means something like there are three gentlemen is not such a bad translation, but there are three men or whatever who are practicing for their own benefit or something like that. That to me kind of sounds more reasonable. To me, this sounds a little bit over the top. I'm going to have to have a chat with my good friend Venerable Sujata about this. But what is kind of interesting here is that the park keeper, the keeper of the park, he's the one who kind of guards the park. He's really guarding his monks. Yeah, he must really like his monks. And he's really looking after them. Maybe those monks, they're probably really nice monks. These are monks who are practicing very well. We know that from the way they are portrayed in the suttas. And when someone is practicing really well, they become dear to you after a while. Yeah, when you know someone very well, you know that they are really kind, they have a very good character. After a while, they become like your monks. And you're proud of your monks. And they are dear to you. And you get this beautiful beautiful relationship between the park keeper or any other layperson, really, and the monastic community in this way, where you kind of have this beautiful, harmonious, and mutually supportive relationship between each other. And this seems to be what's happening here. So he keeps everyone out, to look after his little monks. Or little is the wrong word. Little monks is his monks, anyway. So then the Buddha comes, and of course he doesn't recognize the Buddha. If he had recognized the Buddha, obviously he might have said something else, or maybe he didn't even know who the Buddha was. He just knew that these are three monks. And that part of that, what that probably means, is that the Buddha was just an ordinary, he looked like anyone else. Yeah, he didn't look like some kind of a strange being or anything like that. You may have heard of something called the 32 marks of a great man, the Dvatingsa Mahapurisa Lakkhana, that you find in the suttas somewhere. And those marks are really weird. Yeah, they're really strange. You have like a protrusion on your head, and you have like all of these kind of weird characteristics. And that seems to be a Brahmanical thing that somehow crept into the suttas, and actually has nothing to do with Buddhism as such at all. And I consider all of those marks really just to be a later addition. And if you look at where they are found in the suttas, they look a bit like they are a later addition. That kind of was used to convince people that the Buddha was a great man, because that was the accepted standard in that society for a great person. So the Buddha looked like everyone else. He wasn't three times as tall as ordinary people. There is a passage in the commentary that says that the Buddha... Well, it doesn't actually say this directly, it says this indirectly. It suggests that the Buddha may have been three times the size of an ordinary person. So he would have standing on the ground, his head would be touching the ceiling over here, right? Would have been enormous. So the Buddha looked like an ordinary person. Again, there's one more thing that kind of humanizes the Buddha. Yeah, there was nothing all that super special about him when you saw him, except that he was very peaceful, of course, and these kind of things. So he stops him. And then don't disturb these ascetics. And then what happens is that Aniruddha heard the park keeper conversing with the Buddha. And he said to him, "Don't keep the Buddha out, good park keeper. Our teacher, the Blessed One, has arrived." Then Aniruddha went to Nandi and Kimbala and said to them, "Come forth, Venerables, come forth. Our teacher, the Blessed One, has arrived." Then Aniruddha, Nandiya, and Kimbala came out to greet the Buddha. One received his bowl and robe, one spread out a seat, and one set out water for washing his feet. The Buddha sat down on the seat spread out and washed his feet. Those Venerables bowed and sat down to one side. You can see that these are the standard ways that these things are expressed in the suttas. The Buddha then said to Aniruddha, So what do you think he says? Well, you know that already, right? I hope you're keeping well, Anuruddha and friends. I hope you're all right. I hope you are having no trouble getting alms food. We are keeping well, sir. We are all right. And we are having no trouble getting alms food. So this Anuruddha and friends is a bit strange, right? I hope you're keeping well, Anuruddha and friends. And the reason why he has that there is because the Pali word, the Pali Anuruddha is a plural. So quite literal, he's saying, I hope you are keeping well, Anuruddhas. So because Anuruddha is the head monk, all the three monks are addressed through the name Anuruddha. Yeah? So they're all called Anuruddhas because they are Anuruddhas and his mates. Mates is the Australian way of saying friends. Because I have an Australian passport, I have to use Australian lingo. So it means basically Anuruddha and his friends. And this is a very important point, because very often in the suttas, when you hear the Buddha talk, he will always talk to the bhikkhus, the monks. But that does not mean that there's no one else present in the audience. It just means that the monks are the more senior. They are the main, perhaps, audience, maybe the largest part of the audience, and certainly the most senior, and that's why he says bhikkhus. But in that audience, there could well be bhikkhunis. They could well be lay people, depending really on the situation. And so when you read the suttas, then remember these little things, because it actually means that it is addressed to more than just the bhikkhus. The suttas are generally applicable to everyone. It is not the kind of prerogative of the monks to hear these suttas. And this is kind of the thing that you recognize when you read these sort of passages right here. And this is so Anuruddha and friends. And they too are doing well, they are being well looked after, they are at ease, so everything is good, and then the conversation may proceed. So what do you think that monks and the Buddha talk about? Don't read the page, because if you read the page, then you're going to know already. I'm going to test you first of all. So you can imagine what they will talk about. They will talk about practice, right? Everything is about practical things, how to practice, what to do. This is what they're going to talk about. Kind of obvious, right? But still, it's interesting to see how the Buddha and these monks, how they approach that. So this is kind of exciting. Because these are the greatest arahants in the world. This is the Buddha. Anuruddha and his friends, they become arahants later on. How do they practice? It's actually really exciting. If you are interested in this path, if you also want to go as far as possible on this path, this is kind of the core instructions for how to go as far as you possibly can. So this is really interesting here, in a very deep way here. So make your minds peaceful and still and be ready for these deep instructions. And you will be surprised when you see these instructions, right? Because you'll be surprised at how simple it is and how extraordinarily ordinary it is. And that shows you that sometimes the very ordinary things in the Dhamma are very profound and very beautiful. And it allows you to read the Dhamma in a new way. We're opening your eyes in a new way. So let's see how the Buddha and these super-duper monks, how they actually speak to each other, how they discuss the Dhamma. I hope you're living in harmony, appreciating each other without quarreling, blending like milk and water, and regarding each other with kindly eyes. Indeed, sir, we live in harmony, as you say. So this is kind of the first thing, about the idea of living well and living in the right way and actually being able to make progress on the path. The idea of living in harmony, samagga, samagi, samagga, these are the words in Pali that means harmony or unity or coming together. And this beautiful idea of appreciating each other, the idea of kind of having a sense of rejoicing in each other, in a sense, seeing the goodness in the people around you, blending like milk and water. It's the opposite of milk and oil. No, sorry, water and oil. Water and oil separates. Milk and water blends perfectly. No arguments. Working in unison in a beautiful way. Regarding each other with kindly eyes. Piya chakuhi. Piya down here is a kind of deer. Chaku is eye, just next to it. So this is the ideal, and harmony is such an important part of the Buddhist path. There are suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya that starts off with the idea of harmony, and from harmony arises the ability to practice the entire path. From harmony comes the possibility of samadhi. From harmony comes the possibility of mindfulness and all of these factors. Without harmony, these things are to some extent destroyed. Yeah, if you are in argument with someone, if you are quarreling with somebody, if you're not at peace with someone, it's very hard to be peaceful afterwards. Almost impossible. So the idea of focus on harmony within the Buddhist community is very important. Blending like milk and water. This is so important. Seeing each other with kindly eyes. Remember that, to see each other with kindly eyes. Yeah? Remember to see the good in each other. One of the remarkable things is that in the Buddhist community, like the BGF or any other Buddhist community around the world, there are so many good people. And sometimes we forget the goodness of the people around us, because all we see maybe the little flaws. Human beings, we are masters at seeing the flaws in others. But there's a lot of goodness to be seen. And sometimes all we need to do is to focus on the good intentions of the people around us. There's a lot to be rejoiced in. And if you rejoice in those things, then when you come here and you sit down and we do the meditation in the morning, and you think how fortunate you are to have these Kalyanamittas, you can actually feel gladness for having people around you with these kind of qualities. It's such a beautiful thing, yeah? And so develop that perception of the goodness in the people around you. Learn to see that, because it is there. And as you see the goodness in the people around you, it becomes a strength in your own practice, something you can take with you, and you can sit down, and you can feel a sense of warmth, a sense of good in your heart when you reflect on those qualities. So such a simple thing, and yet something we forget so easily. And we end up instead maybe with disputing because we think, my view is so important. This is the right way, that's the wrong way. Please put that aside, because that is all the worldly stuff, and it gets in the way of the real practice. These are the monks who get it right. They are practicing harmony in this way. They are blending like milk and water. They are seeing each other with kindly eyes. But how do you live in this way? In this case, sir, I think I am so fortunate, so very fortunate, to live together with spiritual companions such as these. I consistently treat these venerables with kindness by way of body, speech, and mind, both in public and in private. Let's just start with that. It's so simple, yet it's obviously very profound, because this is actually what enables these monks to become arahants, yeah? Very simple things like this. So the idea of saying, I feel fortunate to live together with spiritual companions such as this, is a very beautiful sentiment, isn't it? You feel lucky. You feel a sense of gratitude that you have companions such as these people around you that are there, available. You have the Buddha as a spiritual companion. You have a number of monastics maybe that you invite here to give talks who are kind of your spiritual friends as well. Then you have the community around you, all the lay people that are part of the BGF and anyone else that you know in the world. This is your spiritual community. Remember that you are fortunate to have people like this in your life, that enable you to practice properly, that make the path happen in your life. Wow, I'm so fortunate to have friends like this, to have teachers like this, to have the Buddha in my life. That is the right kind of attitude. And when you feel that, you're going to feel at ease, you're going to feel relaxed, you're going to feel a mind that is uplifted, a mind that is able to be mindful, a mind that is able to watch the breath. All of these things come together if you have these kind of thoughts. So, these are the standards we have. Very high standards, but very beautiful standards, very evocative. I consistently treat these venerables by way of kindness through body, speech, and mind, both in public and in private. And this is the idea of what the Buddhist path really is about. It is consistency in kindness, in everything we do. And if you are able to be consistent in your kindness towards everyone in your life, especially towards those people who we are fortunate to have as your spiritual friends, but anyone really. That consistency of kindness, that is where the path is made or not made if you don't succeed. Moment to moment, active with kindness by body, speech, and mind as well. Never allowing the mind to be overtaken by too many defilements, too much negativity here. Remembering that if people get it wrong, to have compassion if you possibly can, except in certain extreme circumstances, of course. Yeah, and then you are developing these things, both in public and in private. You're not just kind in public, but even when you go and you sit down and you're by yourself, you still have that kindness in your heart, geared toward these people, always present, always there. This is this idea of establishing mindfulness at the back of your mind. There's many degrees of mindfulness. One degree of mindfulness is the mindfulness you have when you do your meditation practice. You're watching the breath. That's a very high kind of mindfulness. But there's also the mindfulness as memory, to remember what you're supposed to be doing. And that mindfulness as memory is this kind of mindfulness, where you program into your mind in a very deep way the understanding that kindness is completely crucial for this path to work. And when that is programmed into your mind as a right view, when we talk about right view, these are kind of the critical things about right view. Yeah? When that is programmed into your mind in a very deep way, you never forget the idea of kindness. It is always there at the back of your mind, reminding you. The moment you start to go astray a little bit, that view comes back and guides you back on the path again. So this is the purpose here of being programmed. This is the purpose of having right view. This is the purpose of reading these teachings, to kind of make that program inside of us as strong as it possibly can. This is what we mean by brainwashing. Yeah? To actually establish the idea of kindness very deeply inside. And then you're able to fulfill this path in a very deep way. This is when we talk about metta. One of the things we talk about in the suttas is metta, very often translated as loving kindness, or maybe just love, or just kindness, or just friendliness. Remember that very sometimes people think metta is something you do in your meditation. You sit down, you say, "May the whole world be well and happy," and that is part of it. We can do that in meditation practice. But really, the meaning of metta starts long before that. And this is what you find in the Kosambya Sutta we're talking about before, Majjhima Nikaya 48, where the Buddha says that we should always have metta for each other, first of all, in action. Have metta, have friendliness and kindness in action towards your companions. Do whatever you can, through action to show your kindness. Metta in speech, speaking in a way which always is kind and compassionate and caring towards others. Then comes metta in thought, how to care even in the way you think about others. And then, once all of these things are in place, then metta in meditation really becomes possible. So start with the simple ideas of metta. Treat people well, first of all, in the ordinary ways, in the ordinary life. Your family members, your colleagues at work, your fellows at the BGF, any random person you meet in daily life, Everyone like that. Treat them with kindness in this way. The people in the shops, whatever it is, you treat them in the right way. Then you are starting to really fulfill this path. That is when this path starts to work. It is so simple, yet so profound at the same time. The Buddhist path is not difficult. We don't need to understand all these profound things. Sometimes we need to understand the profound things in order to do the simple things. That's the way it was a bit for me. I needed to have a understanding of the path overall, then I started to be able to do the simple things. It took me a long time to understand the simple things. After 20 years as a Buddhist monk, I started to click for me what I had to do. It took a long, long time. And this is kind of the gradual brainwashing that starts to happen as you keep on doing this again and again over time, reading these teachings, trying to understand what they are about. Okay, let's do a bit of meditation again. Okay. So, any questions or comments, please?
Good afternoon, Ajahn.
Please, yeah.
When the Bodhisattva descends from Tusita heavens and enters the mother's womb,
yeah,
the earth shudders and shakes and violently quakes. When the Tathagata gains supreme enlightenment,
yeah,
the earth shudders and shakes and violence quakes.
Yeah.
Is it true?
Okay, well, okay, so a very direct question. I appreciate that. No kind of beating around the bush, very straight to the point. Did this really happen? And I know where that comes from. It comes from a sutta called the Acharya Buddha Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 123, the wonderful and marvelous. And it is probably one of the least reliable suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya. And the way you can know that is because that sutta also exists. There's a version it translated into Chinese as well of that particular sutta. And the differences are very, very large between those suttas. The most reliable suttas are the ones that are very much the same, whether they find them in Chinese characters or you find them in Tibetan or Sanskrit or whatever, they're largely the same. The fact that they vary a lot shows that there has been a lot of additions and things going on to that sutta. That's the first thing about that. The second thing about that sutta is that it is spoken by Venerable Ananda, not by the Buddha. That's another important point. Yeah, usually it takes the suttas by the Buddha to be more important. And the third is that it does contain all these marvelous and amazing things. And the more marvelous and amazing it is, usually it tends to be a sign that it has been added later on, because the word of the Buddha is usually very straightforward and simple, as we have seen already now. So I wouldn't take all of those things too seriously. There may be some of the things in that sutta that actually are authentic, but many of them are not going to be all that authentic. And if the whole earth is shaking, well, we expect some record maybe. Yeah? In the past, everyone was shaking at the same time. I think, to me, it sounds a bit dubious. So I wouldn't take it too seriously. Also, I wouldn't maybe necessarily dismiss it out of hand. There may be some aspect of that which is true, and some aspect that is more kind of dodgy, if you like. Yeah. So, but to be able to answer specifically, I would have to actually look at the sutta. I can't remember off the top of my head exactly what is found in the various versions or whatever. So, good. Venerable in frontier here. Venerable Punsiri Vara. Punsiri means the splendor of merit. The highest splendor of merit, yeah.
Well, what's the difference between observation and criticism?
Observation and criticism, huh? It's the mind state.
Well, you talk about, you know, when somebody likes to criticize, you know. Go ahead.
Okay, it's where you're coming from, and it's why you're doing it. And, on the Buddhist path, there is a time to help someone and to correct them because they're going wrong. There's a time for that.
That's the observation, right?
That is, I would call it constructive criticism, maybe, or observation or something like that. But I would say that the difference is more between fault finding and constructive criticism. I would say that's more like the important distinction.
Yeah, I'm guilty of that because I've been, you know,
Are you guilty of constructive criticism or are you guilty of fault? Which one?
No, I've been, you know, people like when I train seminary, well, I observe, you know, how they do things and then I try to correct them. And then they don't like that. They said you only point, you know, the bad thing about a bad thing. Yeah. You know, my intention is for them to do things properly. But they don't take it. You know, they said, well, you know, you just point about my negative thing. So just like what you said, you know, people master of criticized.
You have to. I think the thing is that you have to remember how people react. Yeah, you have to. One thing is intentions, and but even though your intentions are good, sometimes people are such that they're not able to deal with too much criticism. And so it's very important that we praise more than we criticize, because people need to feel valued. And I think that is often the problem, is that you need to kind of try to understand the psychology of people and then to see what works. So criticism should be, I think, even if it is very constructive criticism and it's kind of meant to help, it shouldn't be too much of it, because it is actually hard for people to take usually. Yeah. So I think that's kind of that's the thing, yeah.
Well, didn't the Buddha say that Kalyanamitta will point out your weakness?
Yeah, but then again, we have to focus on the really big weaknesses. Yeah, sometimes there may be something really worth pointing out, and there are other things that are not so important. So you limit it to the really important points, and then there's more chance that you will get through when that actually really matters, maybe something like that.
But usually, my intention, I always have good intention.
Of course you do.
Of course you do. Why I said I know that they wouldn't like it, but I want them to know those kind of things. But that's what I had been criticized. Yeah.
Sure. Of course you have good intentions. I have no doubt about that at all. It's just that people don't always necessarily take that in the right way, Difficult to be a teacher, difficult to be a disciple. Everything is difficult in this world. That's kind of the hard part. So it's true, isn't it? Being a human being. Yeah. We have time for one more question or comment if anyone wishes.
Stephen has a lot of questions.
Give someone else a chance. That's a good idea. Yeah.
Good afternoon, Ajahn.
Good afternoon.
This is in regarding to the Ayacana Sutta about Buddha's enlightenment, and then he hesitated to teach. So there's this one verse that says it's Brahma that came down and asked him to teach. So is this Brahma a later addition to the sutta?
It's a very interesting question. And the answer is that it's difficult to know for sure, of course. Many of these things are going to be not exactly speculation, but educated guesses. And it's hard to have absolute certainty. But it's a little bit too convenient that Brahma, who is the leader of the whole Brahmanical world, comes down to ask the Buddha to teach. It's very convenient for Buddhism, yeah? And it basically means that straight away, the whole of Brahmanism comes under Buddhism straight away. Because if the highest god of Brahmanism worships the Buddha, of course, then the Buddha is the highest, and everyone else kind of fits under the Buddha. So it sounds a little bit like Buddhist propaganda when you when you read it. That's what it sounds like. Did it actually happen? I have been discussing this with Ajahn Brahm many, many times, because these are kind of things we like to discuss. And it's interesting, there's a parallel to that sutta, the Arya Pariyasana, the Noble Search Sutta. There's a parallel in Chinese translation, which is much briefer. And usually the briefer sutta that are missing some of the parts are often more authentic, because things tend to get added over time. It's rare to take things out, because taking things out is like destroying the word of the Buddha. But adding a bit more of the word of the Buddha is kind of okay, right? So that version in Chinese translation does not have this whole thing about the Buddha being reluctant to teach. First of all, there's nothing about the Buddha being reluctant. And then it does not have the idea of Brahma Sahampati coming down and asking the Buddha to teach. That is also missing. So in that sutta, the Buddha just gets enlightened, and then he surveys the world to see if anyone is ready to hear the teaching, and then he starts teaching. And so from that point of view, it may look like that part actually is an addition later on. But then I discussed this with Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm said, well, when you are become a Buddha, you are so peaceful that you need something to get you started to teach. Otherwise, you're just going to chill, right? sit back under the tree and just meditate all the time because you're so happy. You know, why bother teaching? And maybe that's why you have Pacheka Buddhas. Yeah, Pacheka Buddhas are the ones that just teach without actually, no, sorry, just practice without teaching. Yeah. And so he argues that maybe it wasn't Brahma Sahampati, maybe some other person who came and asked the Buddha to teach. Yeah? And maybe that is true as well, I don't know. So I would say my preference is to take that section out. I kind of like the idea that the Buddha just goes on and teaches. To me that seems more authentic. Yeah? But because Ajahn Brahm is my teacher and I have a lot of respect for Ajahn Brahm, I take his opinion also very seriously. So that's kind of my bottom line here. In other words, I have no idea. We don't know. My preference is to take it out, just to be clear. Yeah. Okay, let's have a break, everyone, and come back in 15 minutes.